There was part of me when he said we had never seen that before, that the heat would be off me, that you all would be so disappointed in yourselves. But you did well. I don't know about you, but you may feel like the forgetful farmer. His brother who lived in the city came to visit him there on the farm, and he said, I want you to watch this. And he blew a whistle, and this dog came and herded all of the cattle into the corral, and the dog used his paw and was able to hook the gate. And his brother said, that's amazing. What do you call that dog? And the farmer thought, he said, What do you call that red flower that smells really good? And his brother said, a rose? He said, yeah. Hey, Rose, what do we call that dog? You all may have forgot we've been talking about Revelation when I'm up here. Maybe, unfortunately for you, I have not. But we are getting close to being done. I seen a flyer a while back for a revival. The revivalist there, he was going to tell those who he was speaking for about the second coming of Christ. And he included the list of his topics of being the rapture, the rebuilding of the temple, and that battle to end all battles, Armageddon. And part of his flyer bragged about the work he was doing to bring about the second coming of Christ. He said that he had personally gone to Jerusalem, and he had laid stones at the place where the temple area should be built. And there he declared that he was doing the beginning phases of the rebuilding of the temple. And then he boasted that his actions had caused a riot and that several people had been hurt. Well, now there's a few problems with that. First is his theological problem. According to the theology that this man embraced, before Christ could come back, there needed to be a temple built in Jerusalem where various animal sacrifices would be made to please God. But the problem with that is, of course, is that God doesn't need a temple. We're told in the Bible that we are God's temple. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16, there Paul says, didn't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? And God, of course, doesn't need any animal sacrifices because we know that Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice. The writer of Hebrews in Hebrews 9:12 there tells us that Christ did not enter by means of the blood of bulls, of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once and for all by his own blood, having obtained eternal redemption. There is no longer any need for any other sacrifice. Jesus offered the best, and there is nothing more that needs to be added. That's the theological problem with this man's claim. But there's also a psychological problem with it as well. Again, as I looked at the flyer, it occurred to me that this guy was crazy. More than that, he was really dangerous. He believed that he could go, and by creating that kind of conflict in Jerusalem, that he could himself usher in a war that would culminate in Armageddon, and that would bring about the return of Christ to earth. And he was so committed to his delusional theology that he was bragging about creating a riot. He was excited about hurting other people. Again, he was delusional. But again, where would he get these delusional ideas? Well, several years ago, there was a very popular book wrote by Hal Lindsey, and it was called The Late Great Planet Earth. And it is an exciting and well-written book. Again, that is if you don't want to go much about Scripture. The story is well-crafted, and Hal Lindsey's reasoning is very convincing. And here's what Hal Lindsey taught in that book. He taught that Jesus was going to return by 1988, and that after a seven-year period of tribulation, Jesus would appear in 1995, and then the Battle of Armageddon, and thus would happen and begin his millennial reign here on earth. Well, in case you didn't get the paper, it's 2017. That didn't happen in 1995. Well, after that, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson comes along, and they believed that Hal was just off that much. And so they predicted by the year 2000 that Russia would lead a vast horde of armies that would descend upon Israel at that place called Armageddon, and then that would bring about this final battle. And again, that didn't happen either. And so, you know, after a while, after these people miss these crucial dates, maybe you start to get the idea that they don't really have a clue about what's going on or what they're talking about. So this morning, let's talk a little bit about Armageddon. We had that verse as read there by David this morning, and we'll just look at it again, where Revelation 16, verses 12 through 16, tells us that the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs. For they were demonic spirits, performing signs, who go abroad to the kings and to the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake, keeping his garments on, that he may not go about naked and be seen exposed. And they assembled them at the place in Hebrew that is called Armageddon. Now, folks like Lindsay, Jerry Falwell, and Pat Robertson, Armageddon is a place known as Megadesio. Armageddon is a compound word, R meaning mountain, and Megadon could be rendered to Megadesio. And Megadesio was a biblical city that was built on a large hill in the northern part of Israel, just south of Nazareth. And it overlooks a beautiful sprawling valley that can be seen as the site of numerous bloody battles during the days of Joshua and Judges and the kings of Israel. In fact, the last battle to have taken place during there was during World War I when the Allies fought the Turks in 1918. Megadesio's location was strategically important in the days of Israel. In fact, Solomon used this place as where to keep his horses and his chariots. But there actually is no place called Armageddon. The only time that we ever read about the name Armageddon is here in Revelation chapter 16. Other than that, there is no geological location that is actually named this. Now, it's true that the word Armageddon could be translated as the mountain of Megadesio. But the problem is that Megadesio is located on a hill, not a mountain. That's not a great picture, but it's the best that Google Images could do for me. One scholar named John Rushdoomy, he states that there are no mountains of Megadesio, only the plains of Megadesio. And so I'll repeat again, despite what you may have heard, there is not a place in Israel called Armageddon. And the only reason why people believe there is a place called Armageddon is because a bunch of guys in a room decided that Megadesio was going to be that place. Now, why would God use the name of a place that doesn't even exist? Well, I think the answer is, if it's not the name of a place, then it's the name itself must mean something to God. And I've looked at several places, and I found that Armageddon can be translated a few different ways. It can be translated as the mountain of gathering. It can be translated as the mountain of misery and the mountain of sorrow. So basically, I think Armageddon represents that war between good and evil, between God and Satan. The name itself creates an imagery of God bringing his enemies together for judgment. They're going to be gathered there to experience misery and sorrow. And again, there is no actual place called Armageddon. Armageddon is mentioned one time in the Bible. But Revelation is one long story of a war, that war to end all wars. And it begins back in chapter 6. We find God there bringing pain and misery on his enemies. He pours out bowls that are filled with judgment against those who have opposed him. He sounds trumpets that will bring swift punishment upon evil. Revelation 14:20 tells us there that the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Then the chapter after Armageddon, we read this in Revelation 17, verses 12 through 14, that the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings. These are of one mind and hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords, the King of kings, and those who with him are called the chosen and the faithful. And two chapters later, we see, and I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet, who in his presence had done signs by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur, and the rest were slain by the sword that came from his mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and the birds were gorged with their flesh. Revelation describes one long war between good and evil. That war to end all wars. And Armageddon only plays a very small part in it. And again, it's not even a physical war that's being played out with guns and tanks. You'll notice that last passage. It said, the rest were slain from the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse. Well, we know that one sitting on the horse is Jesus. And we see where that sword comes out from. It comes from his mouth. That's not a description of a physical battle. This is a spiritual battle with eternal consequences. First, it means that you and I are part of the war to end all wars. And how we fight that war, or how we view that war, will determine on how we fight that war. And first, I believe that there are two ways churches fight this war. The first group uses a fortress model. They have a fortress mentality. They're always on the defensive. People in this type of church seek to defend their territory. The bad people, the evil world, they're all out there. They're outside of the walls of the church. The church believes that it wins this battle if they can keep their castle clean and undefiled. Their purpose in life is to protect themselves and their agenda in the building that they have erected. Sometimes they'll even go so far to make sure that no one who has really sinned gets to come inside their church building. Outsiders are always viewed suspect in these churches, and outsiders are people who have not been to their church in less than 10 years. These people approach battle with fear, fear that their comfortable church and their comfortable worship might be threatened. The second type of church is one that takes the battle to the enemy mentally. They aren't as focused as defending their personal church as much as they are as making Satan defend his. Jesus said that he would build his church, and in Matthew 16:18, that the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now you think about that, the gates of hell. Gates are not an offensive weapon. Gates are built to protect a fortress. So if you think about it, Satan has a fortress. And Christ designed his church to tear down his doors at that fortress. That is our objective when we go to war. Our goal is to attack Satan's fortress. Not too long ago, I have a friend who doesn't believe in God. He professes himself to be an atheist, and he wanted to discuss some things that he had listened to on various websites and even our own. And you know, initially, I just slunk away. I didn't want to answer him. He intimidated me. And I think the reason why he intimidated me is he didn't think he had anything to lose in this, or he didn't have really any beliefs to defend. All he was concerned was attacking Christians' faith. And I think I tried to, from that day, commit myself to being more on the offensive, to make him have to defend some of his beliefs. And I think that is what the church is called to do. We are called to attack the walls of Satan's fortress, to take back those prisoners that he has enslaved to his will. I think that's why Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5 says that the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ. Thus, the church should be a place where all kinds of people are welcome, even people who haven't always lived churchy kind of lives, even people who might feel ashamed of how they lived. A friend of mine who recently visited our building, I think, paid us a very high compliment. She said that there was so many people there that were so friendly that she felt like she could have had a 666 tattooed on her forehead and people would still be welcoming here. I think that's the kind of church that Jesus died to create. A church that refuses to be afraid of people who aren't just like them. About those two mindsets. Again, the fortress is a place to keep all the good people in and all the bad people out. But a mission outpost is a place to train people in order to send them out to help them find the bad people and rescue them. A fortress is a place with high walls to protect it from the world. A mission outpost doesn't have any walls. They aren't on defensive because they're on the offensive. A fortress, again, focuses more on what's going on inside their own walls. But a mission outpost focuses more on what's going on outside of their personal boundaries. A fortress is a place where people complain about the food and how their wants and needs are not being met. But people in a mission outpost don't have time to complain about the food or their wants because they're on a mission. And that mission is to take down the very gates of hell. And so the message of Revelation is we are at war. And of course, war is never pleasant business. Maybe some of you have seen the movie Hacksaw Ridge, where it tells a story of a man that had such a faith that he went to war in the Pacific, but he refused to carry a gun. And in the mind, there in the midst of all of the worst fighting in Okinawa, he repeatedly went into the heart of the battle to bring back wounded, dying comrades. It's a movie that shows us that war is harsh and that faith is critical in the front lines of the battlefield. And in the same way, our war with Satan is not pleasant. He has no intention of rolling over and playing dead for us. Satan intends to get in a few shots of his own. He has every intention to harm us. Revelation 12, 17 tells us that the dragon became furious and he went off to make war on the rest of her offspring and on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. There are going to be times when Satan will unleash the worst on us and we won't be able to do a thing about it. All we will be able to do is what God's people have always done. To lean on the Good Shepherd who has promised to lead us even through the valley of the shadow of death. And again, Revelation is telling us we are at war. And it's telling us that war is never pleasant. But then if we look at just something else here in Revelation 19, verses 19 through 21. It says there that I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet. And those two were thrown alive in the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. And the rest were slain by the sword that came from the mouth of him who was sitting on the horse, and the birds gorged with their flesh. And if you just think about that for a second, Jesus comes to stand against the enemy, and he has an entire army at his back. But it doesn't look like the army does anything. It's almost like Jesus is doing all of the fighting here. The sword comes from his mouth. An army is just standing in the background. It's like Christ's forces are just sort of the eye candy. Well, why is that? What is that all about? Well, I think this is what it's about. We win this battle only when we follow Jesus. It is by his name and his name alone that we destroy Satan. The sword that comes from his mouth is the mark of our victory. And this is what we need to understand. Christ is our champion. We are nothing without him, but with him, we can scale the very walls of hell. With him, we tear down the gates of Satan's kingdom. Now, I'll close this morning just with an article I read here, and it's entitled Jesus. And the writer says, Jesus, a little name, a small word. Say this name in public, however, in a way other than an obscenity, and stand back and watch the fireworks. This little name is like a detonator that triggers a nuclear warhead. You can say God, and you won't get a squeak. You can say our Father in heaven, and you'll barely get a flinch. You can say Great Spirit, and people will nod in approval. You can say Allah, and people will deem you tolerant. But say Jesus, and just wait for the explosion. Articles will appear in papers. Reprimands will be handed down from the Home Office. Lawsuits will be threatened by Civil Liberties Union. Don't say Jesus. Jesus is divisive, and now is a time for unity. Jesus is an extremist. Jesus is exclusive, so his name amounts to hate speech. Keep his name to yourself. Cloister it in your church. Lock it in your prayer closet. Close it between the covers of your Bible, but do not voice it in the public square. It's immodest. It's immoral. It's unloving. Only one problem. Jesus is God. The problem, Jesus alone brings salvation. Another problem, all other gods are nothing. So speak his name out loud, shout it from the mountain, whisper it in the dark, write it in the sky. Because the name of Jesus is not hate, it is hope. This morning, if that hope speaks to you, we encourage you to come as together we stand and we sing.